Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 22 of Real Talk. I want to spend a couple minutes first regarding the banking crisis. I mean, the regional banks that have gone away from Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, First Republic Bank, and we'll see what the future lies for Pacific Western Bank, Western Alliance Bank, and others. It's a snowball that's gaining a lot of speed, rolling down the mountain like an avalanche. These regional banks are the lifeblood of the real estate industry. Sure, Fannie, Freddie are paramount for multifamily properties, but for all other asset classes, the regional banks provide much needed liquidity to real estate owners and operators. So it's something that I'm keenly aware of and have a watchful eye on. This week, we've got Quincy Allen, the managing partner and co-founder of ARC Capital Partners. Quincy's a dear friend, and he's built a great company. They focus on mixed use, urban real estate, where they have an emphasis on walkability and density in neighborhoods in the Western United States. Had a great conversation with Quincy regarding the mixed use asset class, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
Hello, I'm here with my good friend, Quincy Allen, managing partner of ARC Capital Partners. Quincy, how you doing?
Good, good. How are you doing, Andrew?
Good. Well, let's see. We're used to running into each other, watching a golf tournament at Riviera and other real estate conferences. And now we get to spend some time together on Real Talk. So thanks for coming on.
That is true. No, thank you for having me. And you're right. It's nice to be able to get away at a golf tournament and watch how the pros do it from time to time. So,
oh my God,
we can only dream. We can only dream.
So they make it seem extremely easy. They may one or two flubs at most around, and for us, we hope to have one or two good shots around.
That's right.
So, for my audience who may not know ARC Capital, why don't you tell them what it is you do?
Sure. So ARC Capital Partners is we're based in Los Angeles. We're an institutional investment manager. And it was started about 8-9 years ago by my business partner, Neville Roan, and myself. And actually, we're spent out from Canyon Capital. And for those of you that don't know Canyon Capital, Canyon's a $25 billion hedge fund that until recently was headquartered in Los Angeles and now is headquartered in Dallas, but we'll save that topic for later. But what we focus in on is middle market, mixed use urban environments, and value add strategy. And so to date, we've done about $700 million of investing, and we're really a hybrid. And we share this with you, Andrew, that you know we can do direct investing where we can implement a business plan and then realize on that opportunity. But at the same time, we can also invest in other opportunities with other operators where we see an opportunity to fix the capital stack or fix a business plan, but always with a value add nature in mind.
So of the 700 million or so deals mm-hmm. that you guys have done in your 8-9 years, mm-hmm. how much has been direct and how much has been with an operating partner?
It's been roughly 50-50. Mm-hmm. From our standpoint, we look at it and say, look, you know, what we're really doing is marrying our on-the-ground knowledge of the markets. And by the way, we're Texas West. So, you know, we're in Texas, we're in Colorado, we're in California. But we look at it and say, you know, we've got 30 years of experience in the business and, you know, all this market knowledge. But at the same time, you know, my partner and I have been at all the various stops, right? So we've been on Wall Street. We've worked for developers early in our careers. And we also work together in private equity at Canyon. So in fact, what we're doing is saying we may have good knowledge of the markets, we may have good knowledge of structuring, but there's an opportunity to invest with others. So that's really what we do. And it's been about 50-50 to date.
Yeah. And so when you're investing with others, is it through a co-GP model, or are you the LP and the operator's the GP?
We're the LP. So we are the LP when we invest with others. We do have the ability to do some co-GP opportunities as well, because we have a co-GP vehicle. However, we're the LP where we're coming in, and sometimes we may invest JV equity, pari passu. We may invest pref equity. We may partner with someone on a note acquisition. There's all these different ways that we can really invest in opportunities, which really kind of is the right half of the brain in terms of the structuring. The left half of the brain is really where do we invest, right? Picking the right neighborhoods, picking the right target submarkets and the like. And, you know, from our standpoint, how we look at the world is, you know, we're not only looking at it and saying we want to approach the middle market space, but thematically, we want to make sure that or one of the things that we feel like we were at the forefronts of were what's urban investing, right? And investing in mixed use urban environments. Now that's evolved over time because the preferences for urban not only are dictated in urban areas, they're dictated in suburban areas, they're dictated in medium density locations and what have you. Urban just does not mean CBD downtown. Urban actually means, you know, where's their design, where's their walkability, where's their density and what have you. And those are found in various locations and neighborhoods in the major markets across the country.
Yeah, I'd love to get into more into what you're looking at in terms of a location and activating that that location and neighborhood. And before we go into that, just to drill down a little more on how you're both a direct investor and also an LP, you don't find that often, right? You see certain people, certain groups are JVLP providers or co-GP providers, or they're the sponsor, and you're able to play, you're able to wear multiple hats. Is it that you have multiple sources of capital that are earmarked? One is earmarked for direct investing and one is earmarked for partnerships? Or is your fund just that broad where you can go both direct and JV partnership through your fund model?
No, it's that broad to where we can go direct or JV equity. And two things, I guess. In terms of the demarcation point, where we decide to go direct is when there's a light value add opportunity, right? So if there's one or two dials that we would need to turn in terms of a business plan, where the CapEx cost relative to the total cap stack is under 10 to 15%. So it needs a light lift. You know, maybe it's a timing issue of why we're investing and can still get value add returns. Then that's where we will go direct, especially if it's in our backyard in Southern California. If it's in another market, if it has a development component, redevelopment, heavy repositioning, and it's in an asset class where we feel like having a partner is the best way to go about it, then we'll have partners gladly. And quite frankly, I think, you know, we've been 50-50 to date. We're leaning more so into that. And the reason is that at this point in the cycle, we actually look at it and say, there's a tremendous bid-ask spread, right? Sellers don't want to sell, buyers don't want to buy. And so we've leaned heavily into our structuring backgrounds where we're providing pref equity capital or JV capital, gap equity capital, what have you. And so in that particular case, there's already a partner in place, right? There may be a partner that has owned an asset, but they need to reset the capital stack because a partner needs to prune their portfolio, but there's still some more upside in the business plan. And so Oftentimes when we're investing as a JV partner, it's because we're recapitalizing an asset and we still feel very strongly about the skill sets of that particular partner.
Are you seeing, well, let's talk about the market in general, but my initial question about today's market was more specific to how broad your platform is. And so it's, are you seeing more direct deals? Or are you seeing more JV opportunities, or are you seeing any opportunities because the market has been quite sluggish over the last, I don't know, 8 to 10 to almost 12 months?
Yeah. I would say that we are a net investor in 2023, but I didn't say a net acquirer, right? So we like investing in other people's opportunities where we, you know, we've been in this business a long time. So therefore, you know, we're constantly talking to the attorneys of the world. We're talking to architects, other stakeholders, you know, developers, brokers, you name it, right? And so, and it's not for an eye for actually acquiring an asset necessarily, because right now, like you said, there's very few trades, right? And so while there's very few trades, it's the relationships that allow those opportunities to percolate to the top, because those are the opportunities where someone says, hey, I need a creative capital solution. They may not know they need a creative capital solution, but you know, that creative capital solution, they may not necessarily, they may go to their mortgage broker and say, hey, I've got a loan, right? And you know what's going on there, right? I've got a loan that's 100 cents on the dollar and I can get a new loan at 80 cents on the dollar. I'm willing to put in 5 cents. So that additional 15%, how do I, you know, bridge that gap? And so that's where we come in. So there's no trade per se, but there is an investment in opportunities that we're seeing. And we're seeing a greater amount of those opportunities over the last 6 months. And we believe that that will continue on through the balance of 2023 and 24 as well.
Yeah. And talking to my clients, it's recaps, and making, you know, whether it's refinancings, recapitalizing equity, adding on more equity, preferred equity, that's what we're seeing and spending our time, doing. So when you talk about mixed use, you know, it's a broad term. I would think of it just generically as multifamily over retail. Right. Is that a fair assessment or fair characterization of the types of deals you're doing, or is it much broader than that?
Well, it's much broader than that. That is probably the most prevalent type of mixed use, where you can live, work, and play, right? Mm-hmm. And that the residential over retail is clearly kind of the predominant one that gets developed. But I would also say we look at mixed use environments, right? So we may invest in an asset that may be one asset class, right? So I'll give you an example. We own and operate an asset in Koreatown, right? Koreatown is a very mixed use setting, right? You have new apartments that have gone up to the tune of about 5,000 units over the last 10 years. You have the transit line that is going in and continuing to connect to the west side of LA. You have tremendous amount of retail, and you also have office, and frankly, office that's been converted to residential as well. And so that setting, that particular property is actually a retail property, a retail only property. Now we repositioned it to take it from being family owned mom and pop to really reposition it to bring in more a foodie culture, kind of a cross section of Los Angeles to bring to bear in terms of that particular property. But that's a mixed use environment. The asset itself is retail only, you know, but that is a mixed use environment. But, you know, we look at it and say, you know, where are kind of the hallmarks of urban walkability? And we're an investor in Koreatown, just as much we're an investor in West Hollywood, just as much we're an investor in Silver Lake, where I sit today, as well as Orange County, if it's the, you know, the proper kind of setting and what have you. It doesn't, it's broader definition than when people think about kind of urban CBD. We're kind of, I'll call it medium density urban, if that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. And for those of our viewers who are watching this podcast as opposed to just listening, they'll see that you're in a very cool brick structure, brick building. So you alluded to the fact that you're sitting in Silver Lake right now. Is that where your office is?
Our office is actually downtown. This is a property that we redeveloped and repositioned. And so it's a combination. The other combination of mixed use is, you know, this is creative office over ground floor retail.
Sure. Right?
We've invested, you know, we have some great partners. You know, we have great partners from the family office group that has backed us since we set off on this journey, called Columbia Pacific Advisors. And we also have partners such as Belay Investment Group that advises CalSTRS.
Yep.
And, you know, they realized and got behind the strategy and got behind us because we realized that it's demographically driven, right? We're a shop where we believe that, you know, and we're strong believers in the urban thesis, but broadening that out, right? So the urban thesis is medium density, not just CBD. It's multicultural, right? It's authenticity and what have you. So when we find opportunities either on our own or with partners to do it, then we certainly do it.
And so when you speak about middle market, what is your average, I guess, both deal size and when you are partnering where you're providing LP money, what's your average equity check that you invest in?
No, that's a great question. So middle market is something different to everybody, but our average deal size, pretty broad, right? 30 million on the small side, to 150 million on the upper end. And I know that's tremendously broad.
Yeah.
The equity check size, I think, is a little bit more defined. Call it 10 million on the small end and 50 million on the large end.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being is that, when we started off, right, we all worked in these large shops, just like it would be the same as working in large law firms, right? You kind of see where the blind spots are. And all these shops are great. It's where we cut our teeth, right? But in reality, there's this, I'll call it missing middle, where the opportunities are a bit more relationship driven. And the reality is that we all know that the large shops in New York, you know, like to write $100 million equity investments in up. Right. And we all know who they are. Right. And then on the other end of the spectrum, in terms of friends and family capital, they're kind of like $10 million and below. Right. Those are kind of the pass the hat type of opportunities. Right. And those are, you know, that's where we don't play in that arena as well. But in that $10 to $50 million equity check range, we have found that that has been where, you know, quite frankly, that's 80% of all transactions in commercial real estate fall within that range. But the big guys are shooting for the top of the pyramid. And friends and family capital clearly have the capacity to do the lower end of the range.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we, as you know, we make strategic introductions all the time, and where we as a law firm add the most value is in that middle market. It's equity players are not as well known, except after this podcast, everyone will know our capital.
Of course.
but it's the Blackstones and the Angelo Gordons and the Goldmans.
That's right.
We can go on and on and on. They're well-known, large Wall Street-based private equity companies. And like you said, most people's syndication abilities will tap out at 10 million of equity. And so this middle market is where there's a lot more opportunities to transact. So yeah, obviously you've mentioned many towns within Los Angeles, from Silver Lake to Koreatown and other parts of the urban infill areas of LA. Talk about some other areas outside of Southern California that you've transacted in that you've had some really good experiences in.
Sure. No, we've transacted in Denver, Colorado, Dallas, Austin, Houston. So we've made the Texas Triangle as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we're fine investing in, red state, blue state, green state. That's what we call them. So,
which is a green state?
The ones where we find the best opportunities.
I like that. You know, I'm going to use that.
There you go.
Forget red state or blue. It's green.
Yeah, and forget purple, green, right? Yeah. The green state. So we, and quite frankly, you know, these are all cities that have embraced some form of urban density, right? You know, and we can invest just as easily in and around downtown Dallas as we do in Plano, right? There's some urban elements around both, right? But again, it doesn't have to be downtown. It can be in surrounding areas as well. And so I'll give you an example. Early on, we invested in, we bought from Sears a 375,000 square foot warehouse and retail center that was located in Denver, Colorado, right? And we invested in this opportunity. You say, that sounds pretty big. It's probably going to attract institutional capital. But early on in our lifespan as a firm, you know, that was an opportunity that was roughly about $25 million. You know, the large guys are not going for that type of opportunity. We bought it from Sears. They did a lease back for about 6 to 9 months. They ended up vacating the retail portion of it about a year after that. We were able to re-lease it up, reposition it, take care of the CapEx, and really bring in and multi-tenant, I'll call it industrial. And then we ended up taking the retail portion, which was obsolete, and selling that off for self-storage, right? So here was an opportunity where we said, my goodness, the land value is worth what they're trying to sell this to us for, right? We have optionality in terms of that. And by the way, we were at I-20, if you know Colorado, I-25 and 6th Avenue in Denver, which is literally 8 to 10 minutes from downtown Denver, right in the heart of, you know, an urban infill path of growth. And so we had all the hallmarks of an opportunity there that we said, you know, let's jump in, let's reposition it. And then we ended up, you know, taking that through the entire investment lifecycle, which is, I will say, vitally important when you're early stages of starting up a firm, because as we all know, you may have worked at the large firms of the world, and you might get zero credit when you step out that door. So we were able to, get some early wins based upon having some great partners and a family office investor early on.
Yeah, I want to talk about some of the early days of ARC. And but before one follow-up question on just sort of urban infill, location, the property. What would you say is more important, the location? And I don't mean the greater location of Denver and LA, but like, you know, the neighborhood or even the street versus the property, the physical bones of the property. Or are they both equally vital to the success of your projects?
They're both equally vital, right? I mean, you could have great bones in a property, but if it's sitting on the wrong corner or in the wrong neighborhood or someone you know, ultimately there's an end user, right? You've heard it a thousand times, Andrew, right? What's the highest and best use for this particular property, right? And if it's retail, but the highest and best use should be, hey, this should be, you know, multifamily, but you have a retail, then it won't work, right? Or vice versa. But so I think, you know, the location is important, but what sits on the dirt itself, what's the physical improvements is just as important as the location as well.
Yeah. Location for sure. But, the type of real estate you guys are improving, the bones and the look and the character and the feel, I would assume needs to be, just as special. So let's go back to the early days of ARC. So talk about those first few, months, couple of years, you left Canyon and, what was it like? You know, how did you get capitalized and what were some of the first couple of deals and how did you, set out a market for the marketplace from brokers to operators, and investors to know about you guys?
You really want me to go back? Are we drinking beers or are we just drinking coffee?
I don't drink coffee because I'm hoping for that late 40-year-old growth spurt at 47 years old. I was told if I don't drink coffee, there could be a couple more inches I'm going to grow between now and age 50. But right. I'm still 5'7", so I don't know. It hasn't worked.
I get it. Well, look, I mean, as any entrepreneur says, you know, it's pretty scary when you step out on your own, right? You step out from the comforts of a nice cushy position, you know, at a big firm, and you've done it, right? You've started the law firm, and then you say, okay, will my calls get returned, right? And what have you? So, you know, I would say the first year was all about standing the business up on its own, right? As you well know, naming, location, office. You know, just kind of making sure that people know you're out there and what you're doing. And, you know, the important thing for me and the important thing I think you hear from Neville is that we really wanted to make sure we leaned into the type of people we wanted to work with, who we wanted to attract to the firm. Also, as a partnership, you know, it was for us, it was vitally important that we did this as a partner. So a little bit of background, Neville and I worked at Canyon for almost a decade together, right? So we had been working together, had been in the trenches together. You know, we had, you know, at that point in time, had been, you know, working in commercial real estate for about 20 years. And so we said, at the certain point in time, you really just bet on yourself, but it's nice to lock arms with somebody to bet on that as well. And so we wanted to make sure that we had some differentiation rather than just jumping out and saying, you know, we're going to do a me too strategy and what have you. And so thematically, we've always been at the forefront, as I mentioned, of what we've been doing in prior stops. And so once we got established, we were able to attract capital from a Seattle-based family office group, Columbia Pacific Advisors, and they've been great, right? They've been with us since, you know, that first year. And, you know, I don't know about you. I don't know about others, you know, listening on the podcast, but, you know, real estate is very capital intensive, right? Where are you getting your deposits, right? If I call you up, Andrew, and say, hey, Andrew, I've got this great opportunity. Now I have pursuit costs. Yeah. I have the earnest money deposits, and these aren't earnest money deposits on a house. This is on a $50 million transaction, right?
Yep.
Then I got to put up more money if I waive contingencies. And then, you know, I need my GP capital and my LP capital. And so, you know,
and your financing.
My financing. That's right. Who's signing on that? So long story short or long story longer is that, you know, by partnering with a family office group, they were able to, you know, support us by providing capital so we can build out a team. So that's kind of corporate level capital, GP capital, LP capital. They were all three legs of the stool very early on in terms of the process so we could develop that track record individually and apart from our prior stops. And by the way, that track record is still vital, right? We had invested in about $4.5 billion worth of transactions. We had invested debt, we invested equity. People had heard of us in terms of who we had invested with. We were partners as a firm with Magic Johnson. Who didn't love or know Magic Johnson, right, across the country? But again, once we stepped out that door, you know, we stepped into some unknowns, and I won't say it was totally speculative in nature because we had all of this going for us, but there is still a gap where you, unless you're, you know, have a rich uncle or what have you, then you need to be able to figure out how to run that business till you get to proper liftoff. So I said all that to say that's trying to condense that into Cliff Notes version of those early days, but you know, that really was the first year, 18 months, kind of stepping out on our own.
Yeah, and by the way, the other thing is, Quincy, you talked about all the capital, the capital intensity mm-hmm. within the real estate industry. Not only is it capital intensive, but it's so quick of when you need that capital. Right. This That's isn't right. A long game. Yes, real estate is a long game in terms of right. making money, but in terms of the transactions, if you do not act quickly and show your counterparties and the brokers that you can deliver a 6- and 7-figure deposit quickly, you're out of the game.
That's right. That's right. And I can't tell you how many times we needed in those early days. As you well know, if I would have got you on the phone, Andrew, I would have. But, you know, how many times I had to put our family office partners on the phone to show proof of funds, right?
Sure.
You know, even if we had the funds ourselves in order to say, hey, what the counterparty is really saying is, how are you going to close on this trend? You might have the funds for X, Y, and Z. You might have the funds for the GP.
Yeah.
How do you have funds for everything, right? And so
right.
that bar is pretty high for certainty of closing.
That's it, right. Especially today. I mean, it's don't go for the cheapest form of capital. Go for the certainty of closing.
That's right.
What would you say is the one or two transactions? You know, you and Neville, you lock arms, you jump off, you know, from the institutional world into the entrepreneurial world, and you know, may have had self-doubts along the way. What was it? Was whether it was getting the relationship with Columbia Pacific or executing and closing on your first deal or a particular deal where you said, all right, I know this is going to work.
Right. Right. I guess I'm still waiting for that moment.
Is your wife patient?
Yeah. You know, let me not end this podcast by not mentioning that our families, Neville's family, my family, have been tremendously supportive, right? To the nth degree. So
yeah.
Anybody who's kind of stepped into those entrepreneurial shoes, you know, you say, hey, these guys are pretty smart. You know, we think we're pretty smart. We're humble. You know, we certainly want to be sharp at what we do, but not sharp elbow. But you also need that support of those along the way. And so I would say invest, you know, there's different milestones along the way, right? Investing your first deal. But we don't high five when we invest in the first deals, right? We kind of say, oh, that's great. That's a great milestone. We got it closed. We've done that, you know, 60, 65 times previously, right? It's really, okay, let's implement a business plan. You know, we know that business plan, you need to navigate that. Who are your partners? And we've navigated that, be it with CalSTRS or Belay, you know, or Columbia Pacific or others, as we attracted other institutional capital, such as Grosvenor Capital Management. And so we looked at that and we said, you know, when we realized on opportunities, that's when we felt like we could fully round trip. And then we did it again, and we did it again, and we did it again, right? And by having that, those reps fully from A to Z, that's when you sort of feel like, okay. And then the other part of that, so that's the deal side. The other side on the capital side is, so who has shown confidence in us and our abilities to be a fiduciary along the way, right? And those are some of the same partners. So when we established that first joint venture, that first, you know, programmatic separate account, right? Those are all milestones that, you know, quite frankly, when you're in it, you don't know if you're going to get to that particular point, right? Like I said, I don't know how far. It's like Vegas. It looks really close until you get closer, and then it realizes it's much further away. So it takes longer. All the entrepreneurs know it takes longer, and you know, it takes more capital intensity, but it also takes that much more perseverance, which, you know, I like to think that we have.
Yeah. Would you say it's harder to land that investor, that institutional investor, or is it harder to get them to re-up a second time?
Oh, that's a good, I think it's harder to land the first time, right? Because I think the re-up is, you know, look, if you do what you say you're going to do, I'm from the Midwest, I'm from Michigan. I know you spent some time there as well. I know you're from LA, but you spent time in the Midwest. You know, it's very much just a can do, you know, say what you can do and do what you say, right? And that's how I look at that. And Neville is very much the same way. You know, he's Jamaican by way of Florida. And, you know, you just kind of pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And there's times when you have to do that. But getting that first investment, if you do what you set out to do, you act responsibly as a fiduciary, you know that business plans change, but you're adaptable enough to do that and communicate with those partners. And, you know, you're going to have winners and losers. But the reality of the case is that I think if you do that, then getting the re-up is a bit easier than that initial investment.
Sure. Are you ready for the Real Talk world famous lightning round of questions? so quick answers to the following.
I'm ready. I'll make 10-second answers. So I hope you got a lot of questions.
And then I'll let you go. All right. First will be a non-real estate question. Since I saw you at golf tournament a year or so ago, who's your favorite golfer to watch?
Ooh, nowadays I'm privy to Rory McIlroy.
Interesting.
Hits it long, super clutch.
Yeah.
Disappoints you from time to time, but.
Oh, like not making the cut in the Masters this weeks ago? Yeah.
He's still entertaining.
We'll have to go to the U.S. Open over here in a couple months and hopefully watch him succeed. How about a market, we'll go now to real estate. How about a market that you haven't transacted in that you would like to start doing some deals in?
Yeah, I think it's, I think markets that are probably like Salt Lake City. I have not transacted in Salt Lake City. And I think those would be some interesting opportunities. And also, we have not transacted in Northern California. And I say that to say, you know, I think when the water kind of goes out, you know, everyone kind of paints it with a broad brush. So I think that's around the edges, but I wouldn't say that's, you know, a 2023 aspiration for sure. Let's just wait on that.
Yeah. When you are partnering with an operator, what are the, I don't know, two or three qualities or characteristics that you are looking for in a partner before you'll transact with them?
Two or three. I would say transparency, right? Good hands-on either property management or asset management. They may be on the operator side, but a good track record of being a fiduciary, right? Mm-hmm. And so we've partnered with DJM Capital Partners. They've been great. We partnered with them and invested in Lido Marina Village down in Orange County. And you know, they're one of the best in class at what they do. And so we really look for best in class folks that we've known over the years and we've transacted time and time again with.
How long does it take for you and Neville to get comfortable with a new partner before you say, okay, you know what, we'll invest money with them?
Well, I think it's all part of due diligence. I mean, I think quite frankly, depending upon the timeline of the deal, it could take 30, 60 days, right? You got to spend time with people. You need to not only tour their properties, you tour their office, you know, you underwrite them as people, you talk to people they've done business with, you know, when things went right and when things didn't go right, did they cut and run? So I think 30 to 60 days, but also oftentimes we may talk with partners. Our first deal with a partner may be 8 years in the making, right? Because we've known people in the business 10 years in the making. So,
you know, it's funny. It's a bit of a chicken and the egg because I'll have sponsors that will ask me to make introductions to capital providers and they won't have a deal, let's say. But they just want to meet them so that when they do have a deal, they have already gone through the dating process and the get to know you process.
Right.
In a market that was more volume, like a more active market, like in 2021 and the first half of 22, it was impossible to get equity's attention just to have a conversation when there wasn't a deal attached because everyone was so busy just transacting. Now I can get people's attention to just have these get to know you conversations,
right?
But still, it's not the same unless if there's a deal to talk about. But when there's a deal to talk about, you have a very truncated time frame, and it's hard for equity to, you know, get to know that operator and have a, you know, you're competing on getting the deal. You then have, let's say, a 30-day due diligence period. The operator needs to know if you're going to be standing shoulder to shoulder with them, and right. So it's a shorter time period for part to establish that type of relationship.
And look, there's things that partners can do in order to short circuit it, right? And I'll give you two quick examples. In Denver, we have three or four partners that are just showing us deals leading up to doing the first deal, right? Show us the ones you passed on. Why sure. didn't you like that, right? What made you uncomfortable about doing that? And then we also have another partner. There's a couple in Dallas as well, where they're showing us opportunity where, number one of them was a recap opportunity. We said, okay, this is interesting. This is where we like the basis, but it might not be for us or whatever the case may be. Returns may not be there quite as much. They show us, you know, 10 days later, they show us, here's an opportunity that we're pursuing. We wanted to get your take on it. And here's our, you know, our summary version of here's the opportunity, but here's the risk. So there's ways that partners can short circuit it. So then when you do have a live opportunity, that's an opportunity that you know, you can clearly get in the trenches with and get behind.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful advice. All right, last question.
Yep.
The best advice someone has given you in your career?
Ooh. I don't know. There were so many that.
Pick one. It doesn't have to be the best.
Yeah. I would just say there were so many folks from back in my early days, right? Getting into commercial real estate at Security Capital Group, at Archstone Communities. You know, it's hard to say. I would just say, be proactive, but not too impatient, right? So be proactive and not too impatient. So in other words, don't feel like you need to job hop so early in your career,
right?
Because you're trying to check all these different boxes, right? You're trying to accumulate these skill sets. So therefore you can say, okay, I want to have that well-rounded toolkit by the time I'm 30, which seems so old back in the day, right? Now just, you know, be proactive, you know, build your network. And, you know, there were so many folks that I thought were over the hill at 45 at that time that I
still
friends in the business today. So,
yeah. Well, I also liked what you said earlier, be sharp, but don't have sharp elbows.
That's right. That's right.
That's a great,
you can be motto. One of many smart folks in a room, but you know, you want to make sure you draw out the best in everyone because everyone has something to bring to the table and complementary skill sets. And, you know, you want people to do business with you again, internally and externally. And so you can be smart without being, and you can be sharp without being sharp-elbowed.
Yeah.
I think that'd go a long way for folks.
Absolutely. Well, Quincy, I really appreciate your time, your generosity of coming onto the show. I've always enjoyed you know, working with you and just speaking about real estate or anything and sports, life, anything. And I know the industry of how they perceive you. You're just one of the good guys and in our industry and keep doing what you do. And best of luck to you and Neville and the rest of the group at R Capital.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
We'll talk soon.
Take care.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.